All right, so we'll move to our third case this morning, Letitia Sawyer versus Astru, case number 12-1749. Ms. Schultz.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Letitia Sawyer. Ms. Sawyer raises three main issues in this case. First is whether the ALJ actually issued a credibility determination, and if the Court finds that he did so, whether that determination is sufficient under Social Security Ruling 96-7P. Secondly, plaintiff alleges that the ALJ failed to properly consider opinions by the treating psychologist, Dr. McInerney, and the opinions by the treating neuropsychologist, Dr. Alford, as well as the ALJ selectively discussed the opinions of the state agency psychologist, Dr. Appleton. And the third issue is whether or not the ALJ's violation of Social Security Ruling 00-4P in failing to ask the vocational expert whether her testimony was consistent with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles requires reversal and remand, given the fact that the district court found that there was an apparent potential unresolved inconsistency between the expert's testimony and the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. I'm going to start with the third issue. It's clear on this record that the administrative law judge did not ask the vocational expert whether her testimony was consistent with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. Therefore, the ALJ violated his due affirmative responsibility under the ruling. It's also clear that the district court made a finding that there was an apparent or potential unresolved conflict between that vocational expert's testimony and the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. The only reason the district court did not remand and reverse the case, however, was because of his interpretation of this court's holding in the Terry versus Astru case.
And Ms. Sawyer was represented by counsel during the ALJ hearing, is that right?
That's correct.
Should that make a difference to us? We've just been hearing about objections not raised in a criminal sentencing. Everybody is supposed to know about the need to ask about the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. The ALJ didn't ask the question. The counsel didn't raise the issue.
That's correct. And I believe that under this court's holding in Prochaska versus Barnhart, in interpreting the ruling, in this case it should not make a difference. Because as this court held in Prochaska, it's the administrative law judge has an affirmative responsibility to make the relevant inquiry under the ruling, and that that burden of making that inquiry should not be shifted to the claimant because of the mandate in the ruling. And that's what differentiates this case. And that's why we argued that it appears to plaintiff that there's a distinction in what this court held in Prochaska versus Barnhart and what the court then held in the Overman versus Astru case. Whereas in Overman, the administrative law judge asked the question of whether or not there was a conflict, and the vocational expert said that there was no conflict. And in that case, the court said, well, because there was counsel there who could have gone into the issue in more detail, that the case would only be reversed if there was an obvious conflict, one that the ALJ should have been able to pick up independently. But that seems to, the court in Overman seems to be distinguishing the facts from those of the Prochaska case, where the ALJ failed to ask the question. And again, it really is that it's the...
Was there counsel in Prochaska?
There was counsel in Prochaska. And it was specifically because the ruling has mandatory language putting the burden on the administrative law judge to make the relevant inquiry that this court issued its ruling in Prochaska.
What's the harm here for not doing this?
The harm is that the ALJ, as the district court found, there is a potential conflict between the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, so the ALJ is responsible for resolving that conflict. It's possible that if asked about it, the vocational expert would have acknowledged that her testimony, in fact, was inconsistent with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. She then either would have said, oh, that's right, I'm wrong, or she would have given some explanation to the ALJ for why her testimony was still accurate despite the conflict with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. But on this record, we don't have any explanation for to resolve the conflict. The matter should be sent back to the ALJ for the ALJ to resolve the conflict. It appeared in the court in Terry versus Astru, the court did not recognize this distinction. The court did not say that it was overturning the holding in Prochaska, but merely seemed to conflate the two holdings of Prochaska and Overman and relied on the holding in Overman. But that was a situation where the ALJ had met the duty under Social Security ruling 00-4P. Plaintiff is also arguing, Your Honors, that the ALJ, well, plaintiff argues the ALJ did not actually make a credibility determination in this case. Although we understand the court may find that it was made, the ALJ used unusual language at page 34 of the administrative record. He says, I was not convinced by the claimant's presentation at the hearing. That's his finding. He then goes on to say it's possible that she actually suffered from the degree of limitation that she alleged, but he says that that's inconsistent with the degree of functioning often described within the medical evidence.
That sounds like a credibility holding to me.
Well, it may be. It's a little unusual. The language is a little unusual. But even if it is a credibility holding, this court has held in the past that if an ALJ relies on alleged inconsistencies with the record, that the ALJ has to provide some basis to the claimant and to the court for what those inconsistencies are.
But didn't he do that in the rest of his opinion, identifying the wild variations in the reported symptoms far beyond what doctors had experienced, their concerns about malingering?
Your Honor, there wasn't one concern about malingering, but I would point out that's actually, we have several hundred pages of medical records. Multiple specialists have examined Ms. Sawyer. Some, Dr. Lima, the psychiatrist, Dr. McInerney, the psychologist, examined her on multiple occasions, the speech therapist. None of these treating doctors ever suggested that this claimant was embellishing her symptoms or was malingering. The only doctor who suggested...
Well, nobody ever diagnosed her, did they?
Oh, she was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
She have all kinds of ailments, but we don't know exactly what they are.
Well, actually, I think her treating doctors, their diagnoses are very consistent. If you actually even...
What is the diagnosis?
It's post-traumatic stress disorder as well as anxiety. Those were the primary diagnosis. She also has a diagnosis of depression. But all of her symptoms, the stuttering, the tremulousness, the, what's called autokinesis, this involuntary jerking of the legs, which were observed by several doctors, even when the claimant was sitting in waiting rooms, they observed that behavior. Those were all related to her PTSD and anxiety. If you actually review the ALJ summary here at pages 32 to 34 of the record, almost every statement that the ALJ makes, every summary of every doctor's opinion, except for the consultative psychologist, is supportive of Ms. Sawyer's claim. So while the ALJ makes a conclusion that it's frequently in the medical evidence, the description is different than the claimant alleges, if you review the ALJ's own summary, every doctor that he summarizes says she has extreme anxiety. Her testing on the neuropsychological testing showed that she had severe deficits in virtually every area that was tested. Dr. McInerney, the ALJ, says that his treatment notes demonstrate symptoms that could be related to anxiety and depression. That really, Dr. Lima, the ALJ, notes that the claimant appeared very anxious and tremulous. Again, they really, except for the one consultative doctor who was a non-treating medical source, everything else the ALJ summarizes actually supports Ms. Sawyer's claim, and yet the ALJ says most often the evidence is inconsistent. On that basis, we request that you reverse the credibility determination and reverse the ALJ's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kenny-Kleinman.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Ann Kleinman on behalf of the Commissioner. With regard to the credibility finding, the ALJ did use unusual language. As this Court has noted, ALJs typically use standardized language. They use it in hundreds of thousands of cases per year, and this court has criticized the ALJ's use of that language. In this case, the ALJ did something a little differently. He went and he did not use the boilerplate, and he instead said, you know, it's possible that she could have something that would cause these symptoms, but it's inconsistent with the medical evidence, and I don't find her presentation convincing. That is a credibility finding. Had he found her credible, he would have awarded benefits, and he obviously didn't. The ALJ did provide an explanation of the inconsistencies throughout the rest of his decision. He discussed the various doctors. He discussed Dr. Pegau. He discussed Dr. Bajari, the neuropsychologist. He discussed the opinions of Dr. O'Brien, who was the psychological medical expert, and the opinion of Dr. McKenna, who was the internal medicine expert who testified at the hearing. All of these doctors seem to agree that there's inconsistencies there. There was no cause that anybody really found, no organic cause, no physiological cause for these symptoms, whether you're talking about the stuttering or the near fainting. There was no reason for it. And the severe deficits that came up in one of the exams were inconsistent with the other exams. I think Dr. O'Brien explained all this at the hearing. She said, look, you've got events happening 4 days apart. You have events happening 4 months apart that can't be reconciled. That on one exam, she is severely limited. She doesn't even know her own birth date. She doesn't know the day of the year, the month of the year. She doesn't know what year it is. And yet, at other times, she's examined and she's fully oriented, which means she knows date, time, and place. She can count, as opposed to Dr. Pegau's exam, she couldn't count or said she couldn't count. I mean, there's inconsistencies that just could not be explained, and Dr. O'Brien said this isn't a good day versus bad day type of thing. Some people do have variations. I mean, it's very common. You're not static. But this isn't the kind of inconsistency that we're talking about when we're talking about having good days versus bad days. This is just, it's too much to be credible, in essence. The ALJ did discuss the opinions of the various physicians. He did discuss Dr. Appleton. He didn't make an explicit statement that he was relying on Appleton, but there's no harm there because Appleton's opinion was consistent with Dr. O'Brien's opinion, which the ALJ explicitly relied on. And the ALJ explicitly also relied on Dr. McKenna's opinion, and claimant doesn't have any dispute with the ALJ's reliance on Dr. O'Brien or Dr. McKenna.
That's a harmlessness argument?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The only issues are really, and they're pretty minor, Dr. Alford, who did not render an opinion. He gave an access for statement. That's what was stressing her out, what she believed was stressful to her, what she perceived her life circumstances were. That's not something that Dr. Alford believed. If you want to look at what Dr. Alford believed about her functioning, he gave her a GAF of 54, which, although not an opinion, it means that either the worst of her functional severity or her symptoms was at most only moderate. So if the worst of her symptom severity or the worst of her functional limitations is just moderate, that is not an opinion that a person is disabled. That's not even a suggestion that a person is disabled. And with respect to Dr. McInerney, the ALJ mentioned Dr. McInerney's treatment. Dr. McInerney wrote a handwritten note, very brief, said she was seeing the claimant for her work-related injury that she had, and that she couldn't return to that work. And the ALJ didn't discuss that handwritten note, but it wasn't necessary, because that handwritten note was consistent with the ALJ's finding that she couldn't return to her past relevant work. And the last issue is the case of Terry. Counsel admits that if there's no actual conflict, then this case was properly decided under Terry, and the ALJ's decision, the commissioner's decision, should be affirmed. Counsel is focusing on some language in Terry regarding a potential conflict, but Terry specifically said there wasn't an actual conflict between a GED reasoning level of 3 and an RFC for simple unskilled work. And Terry does not shift the burden by talking about potential conflicts. Potential conflicts can occur, but they have to be so obvious that the ALJ should have picked up on it without any assistance. As this court has recognized this morning, the claimant was represented by counsel. Counsel did not make any suggestion that there was any conflict. And in that kind of a circumstance, in order to have a remand or a reversal, that conflict had to have been so obvious that the ALJ would have picked up on it without any assistance. And that's just not what happened.
Counsel, the problem here reminds me of one that we often encounter under Criminal Rule 11, where there's a whole litany of questions that mm-hmm. a district judge must ask okay. in order to get a valid, voluntary, knowing, guilty plea. And if the key questions are not asked, we very often have to set aside the guilty pleas and remand. Apparently, the word is not getting through to a good number of ALJs. This was a 2000 Social Security ruling, right, requiring the questions.
Yes.
It's
yes.
been 12 years, and ALJs are still failing to ask this question. What's wrong with just a flat rule that says enough, get it right the first time?
Well, I think not only has this court discussed that kind of flat rule and recognized that it doesn't work, that you have to look at the harmless error doctrine, but other circuits have done so as well. This isn't, a one-size-fits-all. I mean, that's the 004 piece, as you're supposed to ask the question.
That is a one-size-fits-all rule.
Okay.
It was issued because of a long line of cases where there was a debate about whether the ALJ should have asked the question, right? It was issued in order to prevent exactly this kind of a problem.
I stand corrected. I may have misspoken a little bit. What I meant to say was that although the ALJ has that affirmative duty to ask that question, if he doesn't, the question then becomes, what is the harm? Okay? And so the courts have routinely and consistently applied a harmless error doctrine to the asking of the question, is there a conflict with the DOT? And that has, when you apply the harmless error doctrine in this case, there is no harm. There is no inconsistency with the DOT because a GED reasoning level of 3 is consistent with simple unskilled work, and because this own court has stated that there is no conflict between an RFC for simple unskilled work and a GED reasoning of 3. The ALJ's decision was completely consistent with this own court's pronouncements. So therefore, there is no harm if the ALJ is following circuit law. The commissioner would...
In a sense. Not the circuit law that says you've got to ask the question, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The commissioner.
I'd like to ask her a question, going back a little bit on this petitioner's credibility, which is being questioned here, and so on. But then the question becomes that she apparently was extremely successful in her work. So why was she trying to fake her way into a disability condition? Does anybody ever have an answer to that?
Well, there's a two-pronged response to that. First, I don't know why she would fake or malinger or do anything like that, but that's not something that the ALJ was supposed to explain. What the ALJ was supposed to do is compare the evidence with her allegations and see whether they were consistent, and he found that they weren't. The other thing is that was not her current job. That Dr. Emmerich, I believe it is, said she was a great employee. We're not exactly sure when she worked for him, but it was sometime before she was injured. But, you know, back to the real question, the ALJ is not supposed to figure out why somebody would portray themselves in a certain manner. He's just supposed to look at the evidence and say, is this consistent with what the evidence shows? And he did that here, and he said it's not consistent.
Well, sort of the other side of the coin, too. From, you know, is she faking it? I mean,
that's a perfectly natural question to evaluate credibility. I've seen ALJs do that all the time.
And I think he did, and he found that.
No. But I mean, in terms of where somebody has a long, consistent record of work, successful work, and you've got a triggering event. Mm-hmm. That seems to interfere with work at that from that point forward, that can often weigh heavily in credibility.
It is something that can weigh in on the credibility. But the fact that she was a good employee for one person, we don't know how long she worked for him. It's not like she had a long-standing history working with Dr. Emmerich that we know of. And the ALJ did consider whether her symptoms were consistent with the evidence. And he found that they were not.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Schultz, how much time? You have 1 minute left.
In terms of the treating psychologist's opinion, Dr. McInerney's opinion was very brief, but she did say that it was her opinion that Ms. Sawyer was unable to return to any work. It's not clear by any means that she was referring just to the work the claimant was doing at that time and the symptoms the claimant was having at that time, shown in Dr. McInerney's opinion, were such that would preclude a person from doing any work.
I thought the note that doctor wrote said she is unable to return to work at this time.
Any work at this time.
At this time.
That's correct. And there's no further opinion from the doctor indicating that she could return to work. In terms of the 004P question, plaintiff agrees that a harmless error analysis almost always applies, and if a claimant cannot point to any even potential inconsistencies, then there'd be no reason to remand the case, because that would just be ministerial. There would be no difference on remand. But if, as in this case, the plaintiff has pointed to at least a potential inconsistency, then it should be sent back for the ALJ to make that consideration. And in this case, the district court actually found a potential inconsistency, and the commissioner did not challenge that either in a 59E motion or in a notice of appeal to this court. So we have that uncontested finding by the district court in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.